It's Wednesday, June 26, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. Here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, another woman comes forward with rape allegations against President Trump, and for the most part, there was relatively little reporting done on it, at first at least. We'll talk about what changed. We're also going to talk about the tourist deaths in the Dominican Republic. Health officials there say that the coverage we've been seeing is fake news, and it's leading to unnecessary hysteria and the feeding into the culture of fear. And a decision from Twitter to remove geotagging from tweets. It's a win for privacy advocates, but for journalists who to some extent relied on it for targeted news gathering, not so much. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but I want to start by what we've learned in the past few days about the conditions under which migrant children have been detained in some border facilities and are living, many without access to baths or showers, without soap or toothbrushes, toothpaste. Young children, some only 7 or 8 years old, have been caring for toddlers. On Sunday, Vice President Mike Pence appeared on CNN, dodging many of Jake Tapper's questions. And President Trump has gone on the record saying that he thinks the administration is doing the best job it can to care for the children. Over at Fox News, the response has pretty much been as you would expect, except from Shepard Smith.
Just last week, a Justice Department attorney argued that the government doesn't necessarily need to provide migrant children with soap and toothbrushes for them to be safe and sanitary. Soap and toothbrushes not necessary for safe and sanitary conditions. Here's the exchange in federal court.
If you don't have a toothbrush, if you don't have soap, if you don't have a blanket, it's not safe and sanitary. Well, wouldn't everybody agree to that? Do you agree to that?
Well, I think those are, there's fair reason to find that those things may be part of safe and sanitary?
Maybe. Are a part. What do you say, maybe?
Soap and toothbrushes are not optional for children in detention. They're necessary. Were these particular children prisoners of war rather than innocent children, failure to provide those necessities would be a violation of the Geneva Conventions. Yet President Trump claims his administration is doing a fantastic job under the circumstances.
A fantastic job under the circumstances. It seems to me that Shepard Smith has a pretty valid point here.
Yeah, I think so too. And it's a story, you know, that if we can't get people to respond to this story, I question whether there's much power left in the press. I mean, especially when it comes to images. I mean, we haven't had any images coming out of these detention centers. We have lawyers going in and telling us what they see, but journalists only get to go in whenever it's very tightly scripted and approved, and very rarely. We saw the image, the poor father and the toddler daughter who died in the Rio Grande here in the past day or two. And if those images don't make a difference, I don't know what will. The only power of the press I'm certain of, though, mm-hmm. Amy, is the power of that last clip you showed with the lawyer. Mm-hmm. Now, you can say what you think about her as a person or the argument she was making, but she is now a pariah because of social media. She's been threatened. She's been stalked. She is being held up to ridicule, and she knows that there's no way she's going to get out from under it. She wrote to friends in Facebook saying it doesn't even do any good to apologize. So this whole story has a lot of different angles to it, but it really makes me question the power of the press if we can't get through on this story.
Well, I mean, you know, I looked at the photo of the father and child in the Rio Grande, and it just made me sort of go back and think about whether or not I'm surprised. And to be honest with you, I'm
surprised
not.
Surprised by what part?
I'm surprised by where we are, okay. The point of where we are right now. Okay. I'm not surprised because this has been coming. It has been coming since 2016 when Donald Trump and, through Donald Trump, the Republican Party that has supported him, when the rhetoric of immigration turned to these individuals, when it turned to marginalizing and deifying an entire group of people, we were headed to where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because now they're not seen as individuals. They're not seen as people. They're seen as a problem. They're seen as an issue. And so the question becomes, and this goes back to what you were talking about, the power, is the public comfortable with what this government is doing in our name in terms of having them in basically what are concentration camps, not providing the necessary things that they need to live a normal life? I mean, we're talking about toothpaste, toothbrushes, soap,
yeah, well, and
diapers. Are you kidding me?
Well, and you talk too about that level. And one of the things I saw on social media, because that is where we are going to likely find a lot of these things that begin to have people think differently, that Anne Frank didn't die in a concentration camp, in a gas chamber in a concentration camp. She died of typhus. She died because of the conditions in the camp. And that's what we're starting to look at here too.
Again, it does say something about the need for the public through the media, most likely,
yeah,
to be able to witness what is actually going on there.
So that brings us to another one of the challenges in that reporting, is that access isn't there. So much of the reporting we have gotten so far, that Associated Press story that broke this back open again late last week, it's all because of secondhand accounts. The press can't seem to get the access it needs to get in there to continue doing some of that better reporting.
And the only reason that the lawyers were able to get in and tell us about what was happening in Clint, Texas, mm-hmm, is because they had a court-ordered right to be there under something that was negotiated before Trump came into office that allows them to inspect these facilities. And so they can go in and they can tell us what they see, but people who are opposed to immigration, you know, are going to say, I don't believe what they're saying. They're exaggerating. We had a Department of Homeland Security person who was quoted as saying that they didn't believe that what those stories were true. If we were there, we would see images of whether or not 7-year-olds were taking care of infants. We'd know whether or not the people who are working in the facility were in their guard uniforms with guns and face masks on. We'd see those things, or we wouldn't.
I mean, to me, the part of this story that I think the media can talk about is because not only you have the lawyers going in there, but you have doctors who are going in there as well. And they're having to, at some point, take these children out for, mm-hmm, some kind of treatment. So there are stories coming out there. What bothers me about this is, what about the people who are in there actually working with them? You have guards in there. You talked about that. Are they not? I mean, I understand that they want to keep their jobs, but we're talking about human beings here. And if you don't have any compassion for children, mm-hmm, in these jobs, mm-hmm, then what does that say about you? I understand you need to keep your job and you have to feed your family and that sort of thing. But does that come at the expense of children, or do you not see these people as human beings?
I mean, do you recall, a few months ago, NPR did a series where they were in North Korea,
mm-hmm,
and they talked about how carefully stage managed every trip was. And that's what it sounds like when our media get to have the occasional tours of these facilities. They're carefully managed. It's just like in North Korea. And I don't think we should stand for that in this country.
Yeah, I think the media definitely has to push back. I mean, they need to figure out. I mean, we take the government, and when I say we, I'm talking about the media, we, mm-hmm, take the government to court every day to get information. And usually that information is either some data file or it's a legal file or something of that matter. We need to, as a group, take the government to court to gain access to be able to go in
to taxpayer-funded facilities.
Absolutely.
There's one other media angle to this that I want to bring up too. And Ernest, you first used the term concentration camp a few minutes ago. The debate or the uncertainty with what terminology to use to describe these centers, and if they are concentration camps, if they're internment camps, and about some of the imagery that the choice of words conjures up here.
Well, we don't want to call it what it is. And we don't want to call it what it is because we don't want to be connected to the historical aspects of what those terms mean. We don't want to use the word concentration camp or internment camp because
we don't want to think of those images of children holding out their arms at the liberation. Well,
absolutely,
of a
but
camp.
You have to remember in this country, we've had concentration camps.
We sure
have. We've had internment camps. We've had slavery. We've had all of those things. So here we are, 2019, talking about it again. And to me, it goes back to the point that, you know, we in the media, yes, we're exposing this, but as a country and as a people, we have to own up to the fact that we are allowing the government to do these things in our name, and we're sitting there having a conversation about what the hell we call it. That I have a problem with.
I can see the argument about the phrase concentration camp and, you know, comparing everything to the Nazis. I mean, the outcome of what happened to the people in those camps, I hope, is not what is going to happen to these kids and these parents. But it certainly looks just like the internment camps that we had for Japanese Americans during World War II. And making those comparisons, as you say, is perfectly valid.
Okay, well, it's one thing, maybe, not to report because you don't have access. It's another to choose not to. And to not cover a pretty newsworthy story, such as new rape allegations waged against the president. E. Jane Carroll is the second woman to accuse the president of raping her and is one of more than 20 to claim sexual misconduct. Her account, published in a book she's written, is both graphic and detailed. There were stories this weekend, I'll give you that, but given the weight of the allegations, it probably didn't get the level of coverage that it deserved. It didn't make the front pages of the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, or Chicago Tribune. It did make the cover of the Washington Post, but it was pretty far down the page. Online, the New York Times added it later in the day to its homepage, but tagged it under the books section. Do you agree that it deserved way more than it got?
I think it deserved more than it got, but I'm not surprised at that it didn't get that kind of coverage. I mean, you pointed it out when you introduced this story. Yeah. This is the 20th, right? Okay, so I think it's one of those things where, yes, of course, you know, we have this story again because we seem to have this story coming up with involving the president on a every 3 to 6 month basis where some woman is coming out and talking about how they were treated by him in a very vicious way, a very harsh way, and with a lot of detail, but it seems to go nowhere.
I think there are multiple reasons why the story didn't get the kind of coverage you're describing, Amy, and I think some of those reasons differ for different news organizations, and maybe we'll talk about the New York Times case in just a second.
Well, I do want to ask specifically about that, but go ahead.
But the thing for me is that, one, I'm not talking about strategy necessarily, but just about the way things work. If your story becomes known, if you publicize your story on a Friday, it's going to get buried over the weekend, or things are going to happen and people are not going to pay that much attention.
There was the old joke on the TV show West Wing, Friday was take out the trash day.
Yeah. And even with those news organizations who made a point of trying to amplify this, or I'll pick MSNBC as an example. Last night, Rachel Maddow was going to do her entire show, or most of it, about that. And a few minutes into the show, we find out that Robert Mueller has agreed that he's going to testify after receiving a subpoena to two House committees here coming up in a few weeks. And that was what her show turned into for the rest of the evening. So there's big breaking news. I mean, this past weekend, we had, are we going to have armed conflict with Iran? The whole detention center story. There were legitimate news stories that were competing with this also worthy story for our attention.
So Dean Baquet at the New York Times did come out and say that perhaps the paper could have handled it differently.
Yeah, I think so too. And it was interesting to me because the first explanation was kind of, well, it didn't quite fit our standards for what determines whether a story like this goes on the front page. Mm-hmm. But it eventually came out to be, well, at least it sounded to me like he was saying, we didn't originate this story. And that's why it wasn't on the front page.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit suspect. I mean, I think it goes back to what you were just pointing out a minute ago. It sort of fell into the wash with all of the other breaking news that was going on. And once that all got filtered, It was not.
She became person number 22, doesn't measure up with war in Iran or what's going on.
No, absolutely. I think that's exactly what happened. I mean, I think it's sort of those who are in the decision making positions probably saw it as this plays into the narrative that we've seen 20 times already, and maybe it doesn't rise to the level of being ahead of conflict with Iran or the migrant children issue or definitely Robert Mueller.
I will say this, though, Amy, and I agree with your thesis that this story did not get the attention it deserved. But I will say this also. Front page doesn't mean what it used to mean.
No, it doesn't.
Because if you wanted access to that story, it was online and it was in your face. You could find it. You could get as much background about that story as you wanted. It did require you to make some effort, but it was there.
But in most cases, that story was actually on the front. It was right there at the front of the online sections of both the Washington Post and the New York Times.
So first screen or two on my phone.
Yeah,
for
absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so I was out of the country for the past few weeks, and I know that last week you talked a little bit about the announcement that Sarah Sanders will be leaving her post as White House press secretary at the end of the week. An interesting little tidbit that was on the Washington Post website that I want to ask you about. Columnist Eric Wemple reports there was a casual going away party of sorts held for her Monday night, a happy hour, by members of the White House Correspondents Association. I did this and did a double take because there has been such animosity between that one organization and Sarah Sanders over the course of the last 2 years that it seemed kind of an odd choice that everybody was going out for drinks.
You know, it doesn't surprise me, and I can't get as lathered up about it as some folks in the media are.
Okay.
I mean,
Eric Wemple, man, he made column after column about this.
Well, I mean,
this week.
He tried to go to this event and ask her questions for a news story. You know, April Ryan wasn't there. Jim Acosta wasn't there. There are people who wouldn't go to something like that. But if you're a White House correspondent and your relationship with the White House is important to doing your job, you're going to suck it up and you're going to deal with it, and you might even go to an affair like this. I mean, in some ways, and I'm trying to be careful not to draw too close an analogy, but it's kind of like, you know, when Joe Biden was talking about working with segregationists back in the day in Congress. I mean, you have to do that. You don't have to brag about it, maybe, but you have to do it, and journalists have to do it.
Yeah, I think it goes back to exactly what you're saying, is that, okay, you don't know what Sarah Sanders is going to say to the next person coming in. So you might want to, at least, you may not have gotten along with her while she was there, but you at least want to show up
as a beat reporter,
show up
just
as
in
a
case
beat reporter
you missed the story.
And say, hey, it was okay working with you and exit stage left, and hope that just by doing that there's no animosity with the next person that's coming in.
So speaking of the next person that's coming in, yesterday the White House announced that person will be Stephanie Grisham. She is currently, until the end of the week, the First Lady's Communication Director. Do we know anything else about her?
Well, she's going to also still be the First Lady's Communications Director, as well as the Press Secretary for the White House and the White House Communications Director. So she's going to have a lot of hats. Now, if she continues the policy of not having very many briefings, which is the president's policy, after all, maybe she can do all those jobs.
Okay, well, it's summer. And that means summer vacations for many. And while it might be the off season for Caribbean getaways, there's been a lot of attention to American tourism down in the Dominican Republic after a number of people died there during the first 6 months of the year. It looks to be 8 people, which might sound like a lot, but, well, listen to this from Michael Smirkanish on CNN.
It's human nature to be pessimistic and fatalistic, even when the numbers don't back up the fear, causing us to think the world is getting worse, more violent, less safe, when the numbers actually prove otherwise.
So health officials there are saying that this is fake news, that it's overblown, and that the numbers of American tourists who have died in the Dominican Republic are on pace, perhaps even down.
When you look at the numbers from that perspective, but I think what's happening here is the nature in which these people are dying. I mean, you had the couple who died in their room under mysterious circumstances. They're trying to figure out how this happened, and it may have something to do with some chemicals that may have been used as pesticide on the property. So that's one case. You had another woman who was beaten almost to death. at one of the hotels by someone who was wearing the uniform of a worker there. So I think that is what's really playing into this. So it's not so much the numbers as it is the way, you know, what the way in which these people are dying.
Even if it turns out in the end that all these folks died of natural causes, the way the Dominican Republic's government and tourism industry has dealt with this as a crisis communications issue has been pretty bad. I mean, it started off saying, well, you know, maybe the woman who died next to her husband or vice versa, I don't remember which one it was, died because they woke up next to a dead person. That wasn't a very smart thing to say in trying to manage this.
Yeah, death isn't
contagious in that way. I also think that what Smirkani said, I mean, it's true that there's some suspicious circumstances around some of these, but what he says generally speaking about, as you mentioned, the climate of fear and us getting out there and hyping things beyond what the statistics would suggest are real, that's an important lesson for us to consider.
Well, and he compares that to some of those cases from the early 2000s, the shark attacks, the killer bees.
Oh, we do that now with shark attacks. I mean, you know, it's not, that's a recurring one there, is the whole shark attack thing. I mean, every summer all you need to have is one or two, and then all of a sudden we've got a crisis, you know. So yeah, I get that.
Okay, so let's talk about something else. There are a few markets in the U.S. where local 24-hour cable news has proven successful, but New York City is one of them, and New York One is one of the most popular local television news sources. Last week, five of the station's female anchors sued its owner, Charter Communications, on the basis of age and gender discrimination. They say that since Charter bought the station in 2016, that their airtime and anchoring slots have been cut, they've been excluded from promotional campaigns, and that they've been replaced by younger talent.
If I had to place a bet, obviously we don't know all the details yet, but if I had to place a bet, they're probably right. And they're probably going to settle. I mean, that's just the way that this business works. I mean, just back away from the specifics of this case and just look at what happens in the television news industry at the local level all the time. If a new owner comes in, or even if just new management comes in, they want their own people. They think, we've got to do something different. We've got to shake things up. We've got to somehow boost the ratings so that we can be proven a success. And one of the ways of doing that is bringing in fresh, bright, handsome and pretty faces on the air, and that is clearly both age and sex discrimination. No question about it.
Yeah, I think this case is indicative of others that we've seen, others that we've talked about on the show. The one thing that stands out in all of these cases is that you have women who are being replaced, but the men who are also the anchors are not being replaced, and they're seen as stability, as the face that we're going to anchor our programs around, and the women aren't given that kind of status. They aren't given that kind of cachet. And I think that's where these cases wind up being filed. As you said, they wind up being settled, because to take them to trial really exposes what we already know.
I don't want to let anybody off the hook on the media side, but I think the public also, you know, basically supports this. We have a youth-oriented culture, and we have a sexist culture when it comes to women in these sorts of situations.
I agree.
Okay. Journalists are only as good as people are stupid, for real. I've often told my reporting students, we're able to do our best information gathering online when people aren't clear enough on how to use the privacy settings offered to them on social media sites like Facebook and Twitter. They post publicly and, well, during breaking news situations, I'm going to be able to find their photos or video. Forget to turn off the geotagging, and even better, I'm going to be able to find it by searching for the exact latitude and longitude where that breaking news is happening. Well, in a win for privacy advocates, Twitter says it's removing the ability to use lat-long tagging. Most people have turned this off anyway, so maybe this isn't the big consumer protection that they want you to think it is.
I mean, and honestly, I mean, Twitter, unlike some other platforms, you had to opt into that. It wasn't that you had to opt out. You had to opt in. And that's why not many people use it.
It's only as good as people are stupid.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, if it weren't for all of the abuse of our data for advertising purposes, for political manipulation, Twitter could probably get away with keeping this. In fact, when they first set this up, they allowed people to say, well, you can just put in there, I'm in London, I'm in Columbia, Missouri, and not give exact coordinates. But they recorded those exact coordinates. That data was available to some platforms, including those that support news organizations, so we could find exactly where people were. I guess I'd kind of give Twitter at least a half a thumbs up for trying to care about our privacy, at least when, you know, it was brought to their attention that this could be a problem.
Yeah, but I wonder if this is Twitter's response to what we've been talking about for several weeks now, which is the fact that you have governmental entities both here in the United States and definitely overseas in Europe and other places that are really pushing against the tech companies, Google, Twitter, and others, on these privacy issues and their ability to be able to use the data that they're harvesting from users.
Apparently, you can still, even with this change in policy, if you take a picture with your camera on your phone through the Twitter app, you can use geolocation tagging. If you're working with a third-party app like Yelp and you want people to know you're at a particular restaurant or whatever, you can still do that. So it's not like that ability has gone away completely, but the ability for news organizations and researchers to harvest that data has gone away.
And that's a little bit of what bothers me about this is the journalist in me who thinks about how I have been able to search during times of, be it a celebration, if I want to get photos from a specific parade, or if I'm trying to find photos or video of damage from a storm, to be able to look at that specifically and target based on location and to be able to find sources that way. That is one thing we potentially lose in this.
Yeah, we've had communication researchers, too, who've used this data to spot trends, and I think that has been useful. There are companies, as you know, Amy, that provide support for news organizations.
Some that we've partnered with here that I've come to realize in the last 5 or 6 months we really have no use for based on what Facebook and now Twitter are able to provide in terms of API and technology and scraping of that data. They just don't have the functionality they once did.
And some of those companies, including the one you were talking about, is going to have a hard time trying to figure out how they're going to adapt to this change in Twitter. It's not the only source they use to be able to scrape this information and supply it to news organizations, but it's certainly one of the bigger ones.
Okay, well, I'm looking at the time on the clock and we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today and a couple that we didn't really have enough time to talk about. You can find out more about those on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. Or you can find us wherever it is you find your favorite podcasts. We're on iTunes and Spotify and on KBIA's website. We also invite you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time and more. We're going to be taking a couple weeks off for the 4th of July holiday, but we'll be back with you again soon. I'd like to thank today RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the program and to Kyle Felling for handling our audio. Tim Pilcher composed the original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.